Welcome to the Wheel With It podcast with your host, Devin Wieters. We're a community that is committed to celebrating diversity and inclusion, providing and promoting disability education and awareness, and having fun too. Remember to rate and review the podcast and enjoy the show.
Hello, hello. Welcome to another episode of Wheel With It. Today, I cannot even believe I'm about to say this, but today we have Survivor 43 winner Mike Gaber on, and oh my gosh, he was so cool to talk to. This is, I know I say this a lot, but this really is one of my favorites that we have ever done, and I cannot even believe that he said yes to being on my podcast, and he was so nice. So you can just listen to it and find out more about him in the show notes. And yeah, I really hope you enjoy this episode. We talk a little bit about how, Survivor should serve as a model for the country, which I think it should. And we talk mostly about his passion for veterans and his life kind of before Survivor and how he got into veterans and all of that. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Mike Gaber.
Hello, hello. Welcome to another episode of Wheel With It. And guys, I can't even believe that I'm about to say this. We have the winner of Survivor 43, Mike Gaber, on with us today. How are you, Mike?
I'm doing great, Devin. Good to be here.
So tell us about yourself, and then we'll go from there.
You bet. I'm, first of all, just like you, I'm a huge Survivor fan, have been since the beginning the show started. I'm a few years older than you guys, so I've been watching it since I was a young adult. I know a lot of people were watching since they were kids, but I was already 30 when Survivor came out. But it was such an interesting, revolutionary show when it came out. And I just think the magic of it is the fact that it's an organic show comprised of people from all over the country, all different walks of life. And you just never know what's going to happen once everybody rolls up on that beach together.
So how about your background a little bit before Survivor? Because I was listening to another podcast you were on, and you are just a fascinating guy. You've lived a fascinating life before Survivor.
I have lived a pretty interesting life. My father was in the military, and then he was in oil, so we traveled a lot when I was a kid. I was originally born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, but that was only for a couple of years. We moved to Texas. I basically consider myself Texan because I've spent 35 plus years there. And while in Texas, I went to high school in Houston. I went to undergraduate in East Texas in college. My parents, when we were traveling, we lived overseas when I was in middle school, and we lived in Saudi Arabia, and we went to China way back in the 80s. My first musical concert was Ozzy Osbourne, and this unknown band called Motley Crue was opening up for him. So that was pretty cool. And then when my wife and I, we got married about 30 years ago, we moved to Australia for a few years and we lived down there, which was amazing. And then we came back to the United States. I have a career in medical devices and I've worked with a lot of different medical devices. And now I've risen through the ranks to this brand new technology called transcatheter aortic valve replacement, or TAVR. And I've been doing that for about 12 years now. And then before that, I was doing aneurysms and then all different kinds of other medical procedures.
So tell us about like how you got into medical devices and working with veterans and stuff like that.
Sure. Yeah, that's a good question. So I was in advertising and I was in sales and advertising, and I just wasn't, I don't, there's absolutely nothing wrong with any of that. But for me, I was just like, I don't know. I just needed to do something. I wanted to do something more in service, direct service to people. And I was talking to an old roommate of mine from college who happened to be a nurse. And he was hired by a medical device company to do orthopedic surgeries, so knee replacements and hip replacements and things like that. And one day I was talking to him and he said, you should come ride with me and see what you think. So I got up real early one morning, about 3:30 in the morning. We drove from Houston out to College Station, Texas, to a hospital out there. I believe it was St. Joseph's. And they had a chair for me because they didn't know what was going to happen, if I was going to be able to handle all the blood and whatever. So they had a chair in case I was getting lightheaded or whatever. But turns out I do just fine with blood and things. I watched that surgery and I just was so impressed with it. I said, that's something I've got to do. So I worked really hard and eventually broke in and got involved in the cardiovascular space with a company called Boston Scientific. And I worked for them for a few years. And then I moved over to another company called Medtronic doing aneurysm repair. And at the time that was very new, it was very cutting edge, but used a lot of the wires and catheters and things that I had known before in the cardiovascular space. And then this new thing called TAVR, transcatheter aortic valve replacement, was coming out. And I said, that's something that I really want to be a part of. And I was lucky enough to work with some terrific doctors, nurses, techs, and basically we pioneered that therapy together from the very beginning. And during that, I've met so many amazing patients over the years and their families. And of course, a lot of those patients are veterans. And so I come from a military background, but I also have been in this medical role where I meet a lot of veterans that way too. And we take great care of everybody you see. In fact, we've got two hearts this afternoon here in Boise, Idaho.
So what exactly do you do with the valves? Like when you're in surgery, do you like help implant them or?
So basically I'm on a heart team and there's a cardiothoracic surgeon there. There's an interventional structural cardiologist, and then there's an anesthesiologist. There's two or three nurses and two or three techs, and then myself. And what I do is before the cases, I look at all the films with the doctors and we look at all the different ways we're going to go in, you know, the watch outs and whatnot. We plan the cases out. And then the case day, I roll in there and then I'll have my own table next to the operating table where the patient is. And then I will assemble the heart valve myself right there. And then we'll crimp it down really small onto a balloon that will go in through an artery in your leg, in your groin. And it will travel all the way up through your iliacs, your aorta, cross your stenotic aortic valve. And then we'll rapidly pace the heart for about 10 seconds while we expand that balloon. And we crush the diseased native valve to the wall. And then the new bioprosthetic valve starts working immediately. And then we pull everything out, a couple stitches in the groin, and the patient goes home the next day with a full repair.
That is incredible. I don't understand half of what you just said, but it's incredible anyway.
Incredible. It's like a magic procedure. In the early days, say before TAVR existed, the way that people would get there, because let me back up a little bit. You have four valves in your heart. You've got your right side of your heart, which pushes deoxygenated blood through your lungs and then back into the left side of your heart. And then the left side of your heart takes your oxygenated blood and pumps it through your body. And you've got four valves that do that. And just like a plumber, sometimes these valves get clogged up, or sometimes they'll start leaking. And there's other things that need to be done. But if your heart valves are leaking, then your heart has to work harder. And sometimes you go into heart failure. So by being able to fix these valves, we're able to extend life. And what they used to have to do is have to put you under general anesthesia, give you a sternotomy, which is cutting you open. And then they would take your aorta. They would put this perfusion, the blood pump, if you will, in there to take the blood out of your heart and oxygenate your body while they're doing the surgery, the open repair, and they would cut out the old valves and sew in a new valve, and then they would sew your chest back together. What we do is we go through the groin, the femoral artery, and you only have an incision about 1 centimeter long, and the procedure takes about an hour, and the patient is awake during the procedure that we do, and then they go home the next day.
That is unbelievable how far technology has progressed.
It's magic. It's literally, it's an incredible technology, and I hope it comes in a coffee or a beer whenever I need one of these.
I know. I hope it comes in a nice coffee and you can just drink it. Yeah, that That would be amazing.
That's what they're working on.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about how you decided, okay, I'm going to go play Survivor, and the application process and what that was like.
So I'm a big fan of the show. And I'd always said to my wife and daughters, I have two daughters, and they're 16 and 19. And I was like, hey, before I turn 50, I'm going to apply for Survivor. And I was like 49 and 10 months. And my wife's like, all right, you're about 50 if you're going to do it. So I got up early one morning, got my GoPro and my phone, and went out and made a little video. And a little 3-minute video, if you Google Gabler Survivor, it'll pop up on YouTube. But it's my audition video. And 3 minutes of power, pretty funny. But I put this video together and I did it as a fan to have fun with the show and to really make my friends and family laugh. And if they call me, great. But I just did it for fun and I sent it in and holy cow, they called me. In fact, they called me several times because I thought it was a spam call the first several times because you always get those calls on your phone and I'm like, oh, whatever, I don't recognize this number. So finally I listened to the voicemails and they're like, Gabler, it's Survivor, call us back. And I'm like, wait a minute, is this one of my friends pranking me or is this for real? And it was for real. And so once you get on though, you go through a battery of tests. They have you do several psychological profiles. You meet with psychologists. You've got to go, because I was over 50, they had me do a full physical, which was just fine. So I work on the heart team. So I just had one of my heart teams evaluate me, which was really interesting also. And then I obviously passed that. And then when the show comes up a year from now, I was getting ready to, if a year from now, I was taking off. That's right. And 1 year from right now, I was taking off for LA.
That is amazing. So when did you decide, hey, I'm going to do something that's really unprecedented. Nobody's ever done it, and donate this money.
I decided to do that before we even went on the show. So my wife and I and a friend of mine who's a veteran, he's an old college roommate, we were joking around, much, you know, me and you, just imagine if, so I was like, okay, if you get on Survivor, or you know, you're going to win, what are you going to do with the money? Because you're like, I don't, the odds of getting on the show, the odds are pretty low. And then getting far on the show, again, the odds are pretty much stacked against you in a lot of these ways. So we were just joking around and we said, you know what? If we do win, why don't we do something important with the money? And we started talking about important causes, and there's no shortage of them, but we came up with veterans, and it's such an important population. It's 1% of our population protects the 99% of us. And there are so many veterans that come home that don't come all the way home, that have traumatic brain injuries, PTS, post-traumatic stress syndrome, that have, then there's the absolute rise in suicides that have been incredible. I saw a statistic the other day that said something like 22 veterans a day take their own lives, and just an intolerable statistic and something that we need to do more to support. So for me to be able to take that $1 million and dedicate it to a group of important Americans that protect all of us, I thought that was something that would not only be good to do, but I thought it would help drive me on the show and help me stay focused on those really cold and hungry days and nights, because I had to do something bigger than me. So we decided before the show, and in fact, it was wild because when I got back and I landed in June on the Boise airport, I'd lost about 35 pounds. And my wife looked at me, she's like, oh my gosh, she goes, I know you were on there for a long time because you obviously are this skinny. We had a little visit. She had signed all of the paperwork that I had signed, the non-disclosure agreement stuff. So I was able to tell her, hey, I won. And also, I hope you're okay with what we talked about because I did that too. And of course she was.
So did you ever tell your fellow castmates at any point that you were thinking of donating it, or was that just a complete surprise?
I kept it as a complete surprise because I didn't want to tell anybody, because I didn't want it to cloud their judgment on my potential win. I didn't want people to go, Gabler was okay, but we liked Owen better. I was going to donate it to charity. I didn't want to use that to win. I wanted to win and then make the donation. I thought that was really important because I wanted to, if I was going to win the game, I wanted to win it based on my gameplay and my ability to persuade the jury at the end. And I was able to do that. So then I did the surprise of announcing that we're donating the whole thing to charity right after I was crowned the winner.
So did you tell Jeff or the producers at any point, or was it a complete surprise for them too?
So some of the producers were aware, because in the confessionals towards the very end of the show, I had mentioned to a couple of them that's what I was going to be doing. But I don't know if they told Jeff or not. I don't know. Jeff seemed surprised to me whenever I announced it.
Because the look on his face when you said I have an announcement is priceless. He was like,
yes. He's okay, what is this now? And no, I think he did, Jeff did not know. I don't think Jeff was aware, because the producers get a lot of information from us and most of it does not make the show. We have hours and hours of confessionals. We have hours and hours of footage. The show every week is about 46 minutes long, and you've got X many players that they film 24 hours a day. So it's a really tough job for the producers to cobble down in a 45 minute show out of all the hours of work that they captured. So I know some of the producers had heard me talk about it, but I don't know if it made it up to Jeff. And by judging by his expression, I think he was surprised.
And what charities are you going to donate it to?
So we have already started the donations, and we have, one of the charities is the Special Operations Warrior Foundation. And the Special Operations Warrior Foundation takes care of the children of fallen veterans from Special Forces veterans, whether it's Green Berets, Marine Recon, Delta Force, Navy SEALs, Rangers, etc. And if somebody dies while serving their country, their children are taken care of from cradle through college, and they take care of them completely. So we donated to the Special Operations Warrior Foundation. We also donated to Veterans Exploring Treatment Solution, or VETS. And Veterans Exploring Treatment Solutions is a terrific charity that works specifically with traumatic brain injury, PTS, and suicide prevention. So they're doing terrific work. And we've worked with those guys. And even Marcus Luttrell and other people have worked with those guys too. Ben Drybergen from Past Survivor, he was familiar with that too. So I was able to get some really great charities lined up, and there's other ones too, but it just was one of those things that we really got to do. We did Advocates for Healthy Minds, Project Echelon. We're going to be donating to Katera, another one that works with specifically with traumatic brain injury and PTS and suicide prevention. So that's really what we're going to be doing. And what we did was we took the money, and when I got back from Survivor in June, I knew I had won by that point. And I started working with accountants and a lawyer to figure out how best to preserve as much of the money as possible without taxation, so we could use it for donation. And we were able to create this direct access fund, donor advised fund, DAF. And what that does is it guarantees that every penny that goes into there has to go to 501(c) charities. I can't even buy a cup of coffee with it. So we had this DAF set up so that whenever the announcement was made on December 14th that I had won, that a week later when the checks got sent to me on December 20th or 21st, it went right into the DAF. And therefore, we had minimal taxes and maximal monies to donate so we could really help as many veterans as possible.
So it's okay if you haven't, and I don't mean to put you on the spot at all, but have you ever thought about giving like power chairs to veterans or accessible vehicles? Because I have that stuff, and I know that stuff can be expensive. So have you ever thought about doing anything like that?
Yeah, there's no shortage of needs out there, right? There's no shortage of needs. But the biggest need that I saw personally was the mental health aspect, because 22 veterans a day taking their own lives is a statistic that we have to stop.
Why do you think that is? Do you think it's because of lack of mental health treatment, or?
Yes, I do. I think that in the 1980s, we as a country dismantled our mental health system, and it was supposed to be rebuilt, but they never did, which is why we have an epidemic of homelessness and random acts of violence and things like that that just happen. It's an epidemic that we've created because there's so many people that need help. And when you just say, for example, you don't have to be on a battlefield to get PTSD. You could be, it's the worst day of your life, whatever it is, whether you work in an operating room and maybe you are exposed to a very traumatic case, or maybe you were in a car crash, or maybe it's something else that happened. There can be a lot of reasons why you've experienced trauma in your life, and you don't have to necessarily be a soldier. That said, soldiers, by their job description, face more trauma than most people do, which is why they come back. And if you're not able to process the trauma that you have, and you don't have to be going to anything specific in your own life, but imagine something traumatic that's happened to you or that's happened to me. We can process most things as humans. We're pretty versatile. We're pretty brilliant creatures. But when there are things that come up in life that are very difficult to deal with, if you aren't able to talk about them, process them, then you just gulp them down. You stay stunned. You're like in a stunned state. And I'd equate it to like living in black and white versus living in color, where living in color, you're in touch with your emotions. You understand who you are. You feel good about life in general, where if you come back with PTSD and maybe you saw something terrible on the battlefield, or you saw something terrible working as a first responder, or whatever it is that traumatized you, and you're not able to process it, it stunts you. You're not the same. You're not able to be the same free you. You're a different you. And some people are haunted by this so dramatically, so profoundly, that they just can't take the angst anymore, cannot take it anymore. And therefore they opt in other dramatic ways that are catastrophic. So by being able to help people come all the way home, that's what we mean when we say that, is like veterans, that if you do say 3 tours in Iraq or Afghanistan with your friends, any terrible things happen, you come back home and you're like, okay, the new Spider-Man movie's out or whatever it is. It's like, you can't just get right back into it. You're still there. And people that can be stuck there for years or decades can be stuck in this nightmare, if you will. And if they can't get help freeing themselves from it, then bad things happen.
So what do you think needs to be done to curb this?
I would love to see the VA, our Veterans Administration system, really start addressing this with a sincere policy. I would like to see the Veterans Administration, because we have VAs in every state in the country, and they, in my opinion, should and could be leading this mental health battle. Right now at the VA, there's great people that work at the VA. There's no doubt about that. But right now, treatments are pretty antiquated. Veterans are clearly not getting everything that they need. And I think it's time to look at new ways to treat people and things that aren't just drugs. Because giving somebody Ambien because they can't sleep at night, and giving them some kind of other mood modifier during the day because they can't, you're treating the symptoms, not the root causes of the trauma. And you're trying to mask over it. And drugs and alcohol will only make things worse if you're not in a good mental state already. So those types of things, I think the VA has the best opportunity because it can be federally funded. It is federally funded. They're in every country and they have direct access to veterans, which has, it's free care for them. And I would love to see our Veterans Administration do more for veterans and to be doing some cutting edge stuff. And I'm working with some other veterans groups right now and using some of my celebrity to help push this. And I'm optimistic that we're going to get something done.
And honestly, this might be too much of an opinion, and we can cut this out if you want me to. But the people that are not doing their jobs in any kind of government situation should be held accountable as if they were outside of the government, because I work with a lot of government stuff for my disability. And honestly, I have never seen people, and there are great people too, don't get me wrong.
Sure.
I've never seen people not do their job and still keep it like those people do. It's crazy.
You know, it's really true. I think that's a great point, and I think it's a very fair point and valid point. It's a frustrating point. There are some great people doing great things. There's no doubt. But there's obviously other folks in there that are just kind of quoting, that are punching a time clock, that aren't working and being as creative or have the sense of urgency that perhaps you or I have in this situation. And I think having a sense of urgency, having a sense of accountability is everything. And I think that we do have a very large, we have the largest government we've ever had right now in the history of our country. And I think that there is probably some of that. We could get off on a different conversation completely, but I think we should probably go in and hold more people accountable, have measurable and monitorable goals so that we can move the needle forward and recognize problems, put people on those problems, and then deliver solutions from those problems. That's how businesses work, right? That's how the capitalist system works, is you have to run that model. And in the government, it gets to where I work here and in 25 years, I'll get my pension. And I'm not saying that for everybody, of course, but some people are on there and they're just like, well, I'm here. It is what it is. I can't change it. It's so much red tape. And the other part is, in our government systems, even if you do have great people working there, sometimes there are so many layers of bureaucracy, like at the VA, for example. I think it is on accident, though. I think that it's almost like the, have you ever heard that expression, the path to hell was paved with good intentions?
Yes.
I think that's what the VA system and or our government has done, is where they've tried to create rules for everything to make everything perfect. But by doing that, they've just created so many rules that they've eliminated common sense. And therefore, you have, sorry, I'd love to do this, but I've got to fill out 55 papers before I'm able to do it. And they've created all this red tape. I think they had good intentions going in, but somebody needs to go in there, whether it's you or somebody else, with a meat cleaver or a chainsaw and just do away with at least half of those regulations, because they're just clogging the system.
I don't think a meat cleaver is going to be enough to get it done, but it's a good start. So yeah. I'm going to pivot for a bit and talk about a little bit about your survivor experience, specifically Noelle and Ryan. How were your interactions with Noelle and Ryan out there?
Man, they were two of my favorites out there, of course. Ryan, the big man, is the gentle giant. He was such a joy to be on camp with, because every day he was just enjoying himself and having that positive energy beaming from him when you're tired, when you're hungry, all these other things, was always really great. Because I always knew if things on the beach were getting too hectic or too dramatic or whatever, I could always count on Ryan being somebody that I could go on a walk with. He'd always like to go. He loved being outside and fishing, looking for food and things. So Ryan and I, and we're friends to this day, by the way. We're friends to this day, and we're planning a couple of trips. We were going to do something this spring, but Ryan is having a baby very soon. So that's exciting news, but he's having a baby. He's doing very well, but he was great to deal with on the island. He was an amazing fisher person. He could fish like nobody's business. I'd go out and catch two fish and he would catch 20.
Yes. Like I saw on the show him walking up with a skewer full of fish. I'm like, how did he catch all those?
Man, he was just, he would go out there for hours and hours and have so much fun. And on the cool person side, he was a 10 out of 10. But you know, that was one of the things that I think hurt him in the game, is that he was away from people too much. And it probably made him easier target to vote for. Plus, he was incredibly strong. And I think people were concerned about him in the individual immunities later on. So some of his best attributes were also some of the things that were his downfall on that one. But, and then as far as Noelle was just this amazing person, another very inspirational castaway friend that, in fact, we actually donated to her charity as well. So
yes, an amazing charity. If anybody wants to donate, that's
absolutely the Born to Run Foundation. It's her charity. And what we did is, I was talking to her when I got back, and that's how we got to the point of creating the Direct Access Fund, because I was like, do I create a foundation or a fund? So I called my friend Noelle up and I said, hey, you've got this foundation, tell me about it. And the foundation is amazing, but it takes a lot more work to run it. Whereas the Direct Access Fund, what we did, it's basically a tax-free bank account that's holding the money that, and then I have to send a charity request through there, and then they will pay the charity directly. But I don't have to manage much. It's easier. And I've got a full-time job, so it worked out better for me to do it that way. But while I was talking to her, she was telling me about some of the things that her charity does. And while I am primarily focused on veterans and veterans' mental health and everything that veterans need, after talking with Noelle and knowing Noelle, she's such an inspirational, amazing person doing great things in this world. She was telling me about her foundation. And of course, we had to support that as well. And she helps children and people that are underserved in the medical community that need bioprosthetic legs get them free of cost or for big discounts. And so we were able to donate that to help other children can grow up and have the chances and opportunities that she's had.
And I've been trying to get Noelle on here like ever since the season ended, but I have been unsuccessful. So hopefully we can get her on here one of these days.
Yeah, she's terrific. And that challenge that she won, that reward challenge that she won right at the end where we were in those spinny things, we were on the balance beam and all this other stuff. And I was in the lane next to her. And as she was coming up, she kept fighting. She kept falling off that log. She was the last one to get up there with the bean bags. But there's no quitting her at all. And she was able to throw, I think it was her second bag that landed. I'd thrown over 50 of them. I'd thrown 50 plus times. And Noelle just rocked it out. She was just a powerhouse. I was really blessed this season because everybody was so cool. We had really cool people on season 43.
And I was so touched by, speaking of that challenge, I was so touched by what Jeff said to her after she won. Was that like we saw it on TV? Was there more to it? Was there less to it? Was that like what we saw on TV?
You know, when she won, I'm telling you, the camera crew guys were emotional. Everybody was emotional. And it was just, we couldn't believe it because she was in far last place and she battled her way back. And that's what's so amazing about Survivor. You never know who's going to win, who's going to rise up, who's going to do something amazing. And it almost looks like it's scripted, right? You're like, there's no way they could have written that any better, where you have Noelle coming from behind, struggling and doing all this stuff. But I'm telling you right now, I was there. It's not scripted. I was throwing my best. I wanted to win that challenge. I really did. And I kept throwing for it. But Noelle was right there. And it was just amazing. I think that's why I love Survivor so much, because it just brings out the human spirit. It shows you the magic that's in each one of us. And you just never know who's going to shine, who's going to really find that zone and go big into themselves. And when it happens, you know, when Carla and Owen beat the last gasp and
yes, like I was so shocked when that happened. I was like, how can you hold your breath for 3.5 hours? Because it's incredible. You always want to try that one and you're hoping to make it like 10 minutes, but yeah. 3 hours? No.
It's incredible. It's unbelievable. And I feel the same way. I was just, and I saw it from, because me and Sammy were the two that didn't pinch our noses. And if, by the way, if you ever find yourself in a cage underwater and the tide coming up and down, you need to pinch your nose, because otherwise what happens is every time that tide goes up over your face, you have to hold your breath, but your nasal passage will have a couple of ounces of water sitting in there. And then when you take your next breath, you'll have to gulp those couple of ounces of water. But after about 15 minutes, your stomach fills up with seawater and you have to tap out. That's what happened to me and Sammy.
Yeah, but Owen and Carl were beyond impressive.
3.5 hours. Yeah. They not only beat the challenge, they beat the ocean. They literally outlasted. When they were holding their breath at the highest points of the tide, they were holding their breath for 3 minutes. So it's a long period, two and a half, 3 minutes. They're holding their breath. And so the tide would come up and you take a breath and it'd be like 2.5 minutes. And then the tide would go down. They would spit out the water, take a deep breath, and the tide would go back up 3 minutes. That went on for at least 30 minutes, maybe 45 minutes.
Holy cow. That is incredible.
It was nuts. I couldn't believe it. But that's what's so cool about it. You never know who's going to win. Cassidy, that's another person that was just a surprising challenge beast. I think she won 3 challenges out there. She was really amazing. And everybody you just never know who's going to win. It's so exciting to play that game.
One last question before we get to Jeff's up. I know Ryan has DP, which is what I have Did you experience him to have any kind of BP related complications out there, like spasms or anything?
Not really. Every once in a while, in his voice, it would say something that would maybe indicate something. But Ryan was just, I think the glow of him was what everybody saw. He was just such a amazing person. And he just pushed through everything. He was the provider for the entire tribe. So let's just say that. That was not a small task. He was, whether he was looking for food or helping around camp or just being joking around with people, because Ryan was a really fun guy to be with. He's a great story. Ryan's another person that you should have Ryan on your podcast, maybe, because Ryan's
Yes,
such a great
I've been
guy.
trying to find them, but I can find no contact information.
I can help you with that. I can help
Okay.
you with that offline. We'll talk with that afterwards. But Ryan's a terrific person, and he's got a beautiful family around him. His mother was made sure that he was going to be as highly functioning as he possibly could be. And he was just beyond. He's just an amazing person. He was bullied when he was a little kid, which is why he's so muscular now. I think he just wanted to work out a lot and get strong. And now he's a protector of people. And Ryan's just a great person. He's just really good person.
I know. And I was so impressed when he was like hanging all upside down off the
Oh my
thing.
goodness.
I was like,
Let me
I have
tell
no
you.
excuse now.
Let me tell you, he was on that challenge, that merge challenge where we divide up into two teams. One of the things they didn't show on the edit was when we were pulling those carts full of those heavy boxes, you know, that split Carla's finger.
Yeah.
Those boxes were at least 50, if not 75 pounds each. And so they were big. We'd pick up these boxes and move them around. We'd put them on this cart. The cart was off kilter. And I was yelling, we need to unload the boxes and then we need to move the cart back onto the ramp. And then we'll put the boxes back on them and pull up the other few inches. Ryan picked up the entire cart with all the boxes on it and
Oh
moved
my God.
right back onto the rails.
What?
It he picked it up and
Incredible.
moved it onto the. I know. I was like, there's no way we can do this. So we might as well just have to take this off anyways. Let's do it now and save some time. And right when I was saying that, Ryan's up the whole thing. I was like,
Okay. Oh my
wow.
God. That is amazing. That is so incredible.
It was incredible. But I'll tell you, Devin, when he did that, it was like something. So I was like, amazing. What an incredible guy. He obviously did. This is going to help us win this challenge, which it did end up helping win the challenge. And at the same time, everybody's like, okay, he's pretty dangerous.
I
Because
know, but that's probably what got him voted out too.
yes, because you're Devin in Survivor, you have to manage your threat level. And when you do something incredible, you have to be mindful that people may look at it like, wow, Devin, she's really awesome. It's really awesome. But at the same time, maybe, oh, I don't know. This is a problem. This is a problem too. I don't know.
Same thing with Noelle too. Like it was incredible, and then she got voted out.
Because we loved her as much as the fans. You're looking at it going, she's so awesome. Oh my gosh, Noelle's such a hero. We love her. And we're like, yeah, and there's only eight of us left. Okay, she's got to go.
Yeah, and I don't blame you because she was amazing. Okay, real quick before you have to go, any good Jeff stories? Tell us about your interactions with Jeff out there that we really didn't get to see on the show.
You bet. Jeff is such a delightful person. He was just really everything. He is exactly who he is on TV in real life. He is, when the cameras are on or the cameras are off, he has the same voice. He has the same energy. He's extremely respectful of the players. I was very impressed with. And Jeff's the leader of Survivor. So if there may be 200 people on the beach making Survivor happen, because that's what people don't realize too, is all the camera people, all the set makers, all the different people that it takes to run Survivor. But Jeff sets the tone because he's the leader. And the way he is, Jeff demands of players, he demands you give your all. And if you give your all, Jeff likes you. If you do not give your all, Jeff does not like you. Jeff is a fan, he is the biggest fan of the show. And I don't mean that in a bad way. He's
In the best way,
the
like
best way. The best way. And if he so Jeff, if you're giving your all for the show he loves and we love, then, you know, Jeff appreciates that. If you are sitting out of challenges, or if you're doing things that are you giving up, Jeff is like, boo. He does not like that. And it's, he would, but he was this great, we only saw him at challenges and at tribal council. So we didn't get a lot of interaction with Jeff because we would only see him at those big meetings. But when we would see him at the challenges, he was like a kid in a candy store. He was so excited, or a kid on Christmas morning, because he wanted to see these challenges. He's as big a fan as you are. And he would be so excited that these challenges that they created were about to be run. And he would really excitedly explain them to us. And then we would do them. And he would be right there cheering for you the whole time.
And what did, since he's the leader of production, what does production do with Noelle's legs? That is something that has plagued me. Because when she has to take a walking leg off and put her running blade on, did they keep them in a special spot, or?
Yes, they did. They did. She had a trunk with three different legs, three or four different legs, and she kept them on our camp where we had this little area. What did we even call it? Oh, the coconut tree is what we called it. But there was a little spot that had her legs, and you could go back there. And if you had to take, if anybody's on any medications or had to do your contacts, or I think Ellie was doing contacts or something, you could keep your stuff at this little area. It's the only area they didn't film. And you could only go back there one person at a time, but her legs were stored back there.
Okay. So it wasn't like production held on to them and gave them to her. She just had them.
She would go, yeah, they were on the beach, and then she would pick her leg for the challenge or the day or whatever she was doing, and then carry that one with her.
So I know the answer to this, but I want the people at home to know. Did Jeff seem to, like, treat Noelle or Ryan any differently because they were disabled, or as you would call it, or whatever?
He did not. He treats everybody exactly the same, and that is what I think was really interesting, because, like, I love Noelle. I love her, and I was in the lane next to her. And when she was, when we got through the whole obstacle course, I got through there faster than she did. We all got through there faster than she did. She was a woman with one leg trying to get across a balance beam and untie knots and everything else. It was incredibly hard for her. And yet she got to the end. And when she was throwing those bean bags, and every time you miss, you've got to go get it. And I was tempted, because I was in the lane next to her, to grab her bag when I was running back with my bag, which would have helped her out. But out of respect for her and the game, I'm like, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to help her at all. And she still beat me.
I know.
That's what I love about it, was, like, I think, and Jeff, that tone where Jeff's, you're not giving anybody a special advantage. Everybody's got their own magic. And to be able to tap into that magic out there is what makes Survivor so amazing. And Jeff knows that anybody, you, me, Ryan, Noelle, Sammy, whoever it is, on the right day at the right time can rise up and do big things. And I think he just really set that tone. We all competed our hardest, and we were all very fair and respectful to each other, but nobody had an advantage over anybody. It was, like, legit. When Noelle won that thing, no one helped her. She did that thing all by herself. And we were all, because we had letters for home plus a food reward, and we were starving, and we all wanted to go on that. But she won it. She beat Cody. She beat Carla. She beat me. She beat Cassidy. She beat everybody on that day on her own with zero help.
And then she picked Jesse, which was probably her undoing, but that's another story. One of the most telling moments of the season for me, it was small, it was little, but when they had to jump off the platform and swim to the thing, and then, what else they had to do, and she took her leg off to swim. And I've had some crazy people say some crazy stuff to me, like, just in the grocery store, like, oh, you're so inspirational, blah, blah. And when I'm in my walker, just, like, kind of making a big deal of it. And she took her leg off, and sometimes I would project to the TV. And I was like, don't say anything, Jeff, don't say anything. And he just looked up and looked down and started the challenge. I was like, thank you. He didn't say anything.
Yeah, it was so cool. So I remember I was on top of that giant floating box. And it was me, Owen, and Sammy. We were looking over there, and it was Jesse, Cody, and Noel. And I'm looking over there, and I'm like, man, I'm a little nervous because the boxes were big. They're like 40 foot by 40 foot by 40 foot. So they're big boxes floating in the water, and you're probably 20 foot above the water once with the buoyancy figured out. But that's pretty high jump. 20 foot is a high jump, and I don't jump off that many high points anymore. So I was like, do I dive? Do I jump? What do I do here? And I was pretty nervous because the challenge is about to start. And I look over at Noelle, and I barely knew her at the time because we were in different tribes, and looked over at Noelle, and she just rips off her leg and just lets out this like Viking yell. She's like, let's go. And I'm like, oh my God, what a stud. I just was like, okay, I'm diving and I'm going to give it my all because she just inspired me right there.
I didn't see the let's go. That was amazing. I guess I wasn't shown in the edit the let's go. She just took her leg off.
Yeah, I think she dropped an F-bomb right when she did the let's go. Maybe that's why.
Maybe that's why. And Noel is like the funniest person ever, by the way. Oh my God.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Julie, everybody on 43 were some of the funniest, coolest people I've met anywhere ever. They were really great people, all of them. Even Ellie and I had that full in the middle of the season and all. Ellie and I are very good friends to this day.
Yeah. You guys seem like the best cast because you guys can, sometimes there's like kerfuffles when they come home over stuff that happened on the island, but you guys don't seem to have that at all.
We were a really close group out there, had a lot of fun together, and continue to have fun together.
I know you have to get off, but is there anything else you would like to add before we're done here?
Oh, wow. Thank you so much for having me on. I loved your questions. We'll talk offline about getting Ryan and Noelle's contacts and things like that. They're just great people. Everybody on the show was amazing. I'm so grateful that so many people were on this journey with me because they do such a great job filming it with the drones and all the cameras they have out. And production does such a masterful job telling the story and keeping the audience guessing. It was just such an amazing adventure. And so many people got to see it in real time with me, which is amazing. I thought that was just so cool. You saw everything we're talking about. You were there, minus the starvation. You were there. And it was really, really great that so many people got to be on this incredible adventure. I love the show Survivor. It brings out the best in us and it shows what we can all do if we just be real. We don't have to, on Survivor, we're people from all different walks of life, different ages, backgrounds, educations, everything. And we got along so well. And it's like a little microcosm of what the America is. And I'd love to see us doing a better job.
Or should be like, by the way.
Yes, exactly. We could do it on Survivor with no food and a lot of stress. I think back in the normal world, people can do that better because we just really loved each other and took care of each other. We competed against each other, but we took care of each other. And I think that's really the bottom line. And everybody's very respectful of each other. And we just had a lot of fun.
And I debated whether I should say this or not, but I want to be a TV producer one day. And my dream show is Survivor. So I don't know how I'm going to get on it, but because I want it to be in a fair way, I don't want them to take me on just because I'm a super fan who happens to have a disability. I want to be on there because I'm skilled at it, but obviously I can't be a dream teamer. So we're going to have to figure out another way.
Maybe we can talk a little bit more offline too, because I think that's a great idea. There's so many Survivor franchises now around the world that are going on. And there's a lot of them. And it's really blossomed because what I love about international Survivor is culturally, yes, it's different because every country is different. But the uniqueness of the show continues. And that's the genius of the show, because it's a human show. It's organic, based on people. And I think that somebody that's passionate like you are, the harder you work, the luckier you get. And you work clearly very hard, and you're able to find me and bring me onto this cast. I'm sure you can do a lot of other amazing things, and I'll be able to help you with a couple of those things. But life is short, life is now, and you've got to live it. So if that's something you want to do, put your head down and you make it happen.
It would have to be a work from home position for now, because I'm not able to live on my own just yet, but yeah, we're going to get there in a few years.
Yes. Okay. I think that is wonderful. You're going to get there. You just take your time. You're young, right? I'm 52. You're a youngster, but take your time. You're focused and you're smart and you've got a cool personality. Maybe you'll be on Survivor. You ever want to be on the show?
I would, but there's this whole thing of a wheelchair. I don't know how they're going to do that. But
you never know, right? You just never know. We'll see. Because look how far they've come, Devin. They've had, like on my season, you got the first above the knee amputee on the show. And she made it deep into the game and only got voted out because she was a threat. It wasn't because of anything else. She was kicking ass all the way through it. And Ryan, yes, he's able to walk and things like that, but he was able to get on there with his disability and he was doing fantastic. In fact, I didn't even know he had a disability until he told me. We were fishing one day and I was like, what? I didn't even understand, because he was such a big person. He's such a big smile, giant body, very strong. And I was like, oh, no kidding. That's what's cool is nobody cares. Everybody just cares about the person themselves, the person who they are. And I think Survivor is such a warm and welcoming place that, and Jeff is so mindful of inclusion. He wants to make sure that Survivor represents everybody.
And it's not just to be cool. It's not just because everybody else is doing it. He genuinely is that. Like,
yes,
I've never seen anything like it.
No, it's true. And you know what? I think it is, to your point. He wants everybody like that, not because it's cool, because it's actually great television. When you get people of different walks of life, put them together, and it's a different, you want everybody represented. If you had 12 Ryans out there, 18 Ryans out there, it's not as interesting as if you have one Ryan out there with one Noel, with one Jesse, with one Owen, with one, it's like everybody's different and brings something to the party. And the more diverse the backgrounds, the more interesting the party. And I think that's Jeff's secret sauce, is that he wants everybody to be included because everybody brings something special.
Which is incredible and makes me mad when I see all, I don't do Twitter anymore because it's hateful, but when I used to see all that stuff about on Twitter about, oh, he's this, he's that, I'm like, if you only knew.
You mentioned Twitter. When I was not on any social media until I got on Survivor. And then last year in summer when I got back, I opened an Instagram account and a Twitter account. I still have both of them. The Instagram is the one I post on the most because it's friendly. It's what it's supposed to be. Twitter, there are so many trolls out there. It's like people were even upset with me for donating to veterans. They were like, oh, well, it's a swamp. Are you kidding me? If you're on Twitter, just, I think they're trying to clean it up because it is pretty venomous and there's a lot of haters out there just say things to be mean and stuff. And I don't understand it. I don't know why anybody would take the time to write a nasty message to somebody that they don't know.
I know. Sorry, our phone is linking. The stuff I've seen about Jeff on Twitter is just, I can't, like,
It's all BS. Because Jeff is a really good person and cares a lot about not only Survivor, but the social impact of the show and everything else. And he is a very conscientious and good person. And you can nitpick anybody in the world and everybody is welcome to do that. But there's other people. Jeff's not part of the problem. He's part of the solution.
I know. If we had 400 Jeffs in the ward, it would be a better price. I'm sorry.
Yes, yeah, said, you're exactly right. No, it's been great. I've really enjoyed this conversation. And We will stay in touch with each other. I think I can put you in contact with a couple people that you're looking for. And maybe even you can even talk with, I still have contacts with a couple producers. So okay. Maybe you can visit with one or two of them and to get yourself started, maybe they can give you some words of advice on how to take your career forward and things like that, because you just never know. And we're living in this great technological time where at the beginning of our conversation, we're talking about some of the amazing medical advancements that have happened with heart surgery, and they're doing all kinds of different things, whether we're talking about mental health or physical health or cardiovascular health, whatever it is, there's a lot of things that are moving forward. And with technology, even us doing this podcast together. So we're across the country doing this Zoom call together. And maybe there's going to be things and opportunities with technology coming forward that are going to make that bridge much easier to navigate, to get over those rivers that are right now, maybe that are harder for you to cross. You'll be crossing them with ease in a couple of years.
Yeah, like 10 years is going to be a totally different thing. Yeah. So I know you have to run. I want to be respectful of your time, but thank you so much for being on here. And we will see you guys next episode. Bye, guys.
Take care, everybody.
Thanks for listening to Wheel With It. You can support the show by visiting our website, wheelwithit.com, following us on social media, and financially supporting us. You can find all those links in the show notes. See you next time.